Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And let's start the hour with the news that the drug maker AstraZeneca, which is in partnership with the University of Oxford in England, has put its COVID-19 vaccine, one of nine potential vaccines in a phase 3 trial, on pause after discovering that a trial participant in the UK had a serious adverse reaction. Adam Feuerstein is covering this for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. And Adam, hearing that a COVID-19 vaccine study has been put on hold is concerning, but you say this also means the system is working.
Yeah, now obviously these vaccines that are being developed for COVID-19 are being very closely followed. This is probably not the news that people wanted to hear, but I think you're right, Robin, in that, you know, clinical trials are set up to not only determine the efficacy of a vaccine, but also to determine its safety. And in this case, you know, you want a clinical trial to be able to pick up an adverse event, a safety issue, if one exists.
Yeah. And all of the companies behind these potential vaccines have signed a statement saying that they will not release anything under any pressure before they think it's completely safe. So this is, in fact, kind of underscoring that, perhaps. But in a statement at NPR, the company said the next step will be to determine if the illness is related to the vaccine or just a chance event. How do they do that? What do we know so far?
Well, right. And as you can imagine, the participants in these clinical trials are closely monitored. You know, the ultimate goal of a vaccine clinical trial is to determine whether the vaccine can protect people from infection from COVID-19. So you monitor these patients. And so when an adverse event comes up, you know, some sort of side effect that is unexplained, that will be communicated to the people who are monitoring the safety of the clinical trial. And then depending on the severity or the seriousness of that side effect, you know, certain steps will be taken. Now, in this case, AstraZeneca and the University of Oxford have paused their clinical trials. So what that tells you is that this was a serious adverse event. I mean, yeah. if a patient just reported a mild headache, that wouldn't stop a clinical trial.
Well, even if it's more than that, we've mentioned before, we have a colleague whose husband is in the Pfizer trial. He got very, very ill. He had vertigo, couldn't sit up. He was nauseous, terrible headache, and didn't have a fever. And it was not of concern. In other words, it was one of the reactions that was expected to a vaccination. So this must have been a serious reaction. But when you say pause the trial, we know that thousands have already had their two doses of the vaccine. When you say pause, what does that mean? Stopping new enrollments? What does that mean?
Well, what that means, and it's not entirely clear, but based on our reporting, what it means is that particularly the U.S.-based clinical trial, and that's a trial that AstraZeneca just recently started at the end of August, that patients who have been enrolled in that study or scheduled to receive their first vaccinations have basically been put on hold. They've been told to, call later. We will reschedule your appointment. So at this point, no one is getting vaccinations until they determine, you know, the cause. That the patient who experienced this adverse event was in the UK, so presumably was in the UK-based study, and that's a study that's further along than the one that was in the US, which just started.
Well, and we know it was going well in the UK because The Lancet reported in July that there had been no adverse effects there. But now that there is this pause, what does it mean for other companies' trials? We know AstraZeneca ultimately hopes to do the same thing the other drug makers hope to do, which is encourage the body to produce antibodies to fight off COVID-19. But they have different delivery systems, you know, into the body, the way they're, you know, asking cells to do that. So what does the fact that AstraZeneca has paused mean for the other companies' trials?
Just remember that there are different vaccines using different technologies, right? So not all the vaccines are going to have sort of the same side effect profile. And that's one of the reasons why these clinical trials are important, because we will sort of get a sense of what the side effects are for each individual vaccine. So what this means for the other drug makers, I think it's just a reminder that, you know, safety is just as important as the efficacy of these vaccines, particularly when you consider that potentially they're going to be given to millions and millions of people. And it's the reason why the drug makers are running these really large clinical trials, right? We're talking about tens of thousands of participants, because when you do clinical trials of that size, that's when you are better able to suss out the safety of these vaccines. If there is some very rare side effect that occurs, you know, it's very difficult to find that potentially if you only have, let's say, a dozen or maybe even 100 participants. Mm-hmm. But when you have tens of thousands of people, that's where you are better able to identify potential risks.
Adam Feuerstein, senior writer at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Adam, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
The photos out of the San Francisco Bay Area this morning are unbelievable. The sky bright orange as many states in the West are literally on fire. In Washington state, officials say more than 300,000 acres have burned since Monday. Governor Jay Inslee called it an unprecedented and heartbreaking event.
We know that we've been well prepared for fires, but these conditions were unprecedented. They led to explosive growth of these fires as a result of the hot and windy and very, very low humidity conditions that were so extraordinary yesterday in the state of Washington.
Fires are also raging in Oregon and California, pumping thick smoke and ash into the air, causing poor and in some areas hazardous air quality. Let's bring in Bonnie Holmes-Jen, chief of the Health and Exposure Assessment Branch in the Research Division of the California Air Resources Board. Bonnie, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Well, how dangerous is the smoke and the ash that's in the air to the respiratory system, especially when it's so dense?
Yeah, smoke particles, the soot and the ash and the dust are very dangerous. They can build up in our bodies and they can cause a number of immediate health problems, ranging from, you know, itching, burning eyes and scratchy throat and shortness of breath, but also can cause long-term problems and can particularly cause problems for anyone who has asthma or other lung or cardiac illnesses. Anybody with existing lung or heart conditions is particularly vulnerable to smoke.
So is there anything that can be done, though, other than just staying inside and closing all the windows? Is that even a possibility?
Well, we do recommend that if you can smell smoke and if you look on the smoke map and see that your area is affected, that it probably is best to stay indoors and to use your air conditioning and to make sure that you have a clean air space. It is important to protect your lungs. Our lungs are very sensitive. Lungs are not meant to breathe in these amounts of hazardous particles. So it is important to protect yourself and stay indoors. And again, make sure you have a clean air environment. Use a high efficiency particulate filter in your air conditioning system if you can.
And for those of us who are not in the West right now, give us a sense, is it changing by the hour? Do people have to keep track all the time of what's happening with the air quality? Or is it typically, you know, it's really bad for a couple of days and then maybe it gets better?
I would recommend that people become very familiar with sites like airnow.gov that provides the latest monitoring information. People can look up the air quality by zip code. And I do think it's important to check it several times throughout the day because the air quality conditions do change depending on the smoke from the fires.
Yesterday, the governor of California, Gavin Newsom, said the state's 7-day positivity rate of coronavirus cases has dropped, as is the hospitalization rate. Could the air pollution as a result of these wildfires have any effect in the context of COVID-19?
Well, we know from research that's been conducted that people that live in areas where there's long-term exposure to elevated levels of air pollution are at greater risk for hospitalizations or deaths from COVID-19. So we do know this from research. Basically, smoke pollution is an assault on the lungs, and anybody who has a compromised lungs or heart because of existing conditions is at higher risk. So we do encourage people to take protective measures, particularly if they are especially vulnerable or sensitive to pollution or have any existing respiratory infections.
Obviously, fires happen every year in parts of the West. How does this compare, though, in terms of the air quality to previous years that you've been around?
You know, the air quality and the fires have been particularly dangerous this year. We've had areas across the state experiencing poor air quality, ranging from unhealthy for sensitive groups to unhealthy to even hazardous conditions. We've had more than a quarter of the state that's been experiencing fires and bad air quality. So, you know, it is a particularly bad year for air quality, and people need to be particularly concerned and take protective measures to protect their lungs.
Do you expect the bad air to spread to the east as the winds carry it across state lines?
Yes, the smoke can be carried across state lines to neighboring states. Our fires in California are affecting surrounding states, and the smoke can have quite a wide reach. It can travel thousands of miles. People do need to be aware of that, and that's why it's really important to check the latest airnow.gov maps and see where the smoke is affecting areas.
That is Bonnie Holmes-Jen, who is the chief of the Health and Exposure Assessment Branch in the Research Division of the California Air Resources Board. Bonnie, thank you for joining us.
You're so welcome.
There are shocking new details being reported today from journalist Bob Woodward's upcoming book. He has tapes of President Trump saying he knowingly downplayed the coronavirus when he knew how deadly it was.
And we're also following the Justice Department's move to take over the defense of President Trump in a case involving decades-old sexual assault allegations, which means taxpayers could be paying his legal bills on that. Our political strategists join us, and this week we have Alice Stewart, the Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Great to be here.
And nice to see you. And Bill Press, the Democrat. Hi, nice to see you too, Bill.
Hey, good to be back with you, Robin. Hi.
Yeah. And Alice, I want to start with you. This President Trump legal case is not about the alleged event, the claim that citizen Donald Trump sexually assaulted the accuser, author E. Jean Carroll, back in the 90s in New York. This case is about how, while president, Donald Trump called her a liar when she made the accusation publicly. So it's a lawsuit she is suing for defamation. Now, Attorney General Barr says since while that accusation of defamation happened while the president was in office, it's within his jurisdiction. Let's listen.
The law is clear. It is done frequently. And the little tempest that's going on is largely because of the bizarre political environment in which we live.
But Alice, as you know, some law professors are disagreeing. You've got University of Texas law professor Steve Vladek saying, yes, the DOJ has to represent all employees accused of doing something wrong while in office. But Vladek then writes, how does a decades-old charge have anything to do with Trump's role as president? Doesn't this give the whiff again that William Barr is simply protecting this president and not serving justice, and that taxpayers are going to be stuck with the legal bills when he does that?
Well, if you want to find the president at fault in everything that he does, I could see where you might come across to that conclusion. But the truth is, when we have an allegation of this nature and an ongoing investigation, the best advice is to simply not comment. However, when the president doing so, I do think the comments have been inappropriate, but Barr's actions...
Which ones? The comments that she's a liar? Those comments? Yeah,
absolutely. He should just not comment on any kind of ongoing inquiry such as this. But to Barr's defense, he does have the legal jurisdiction to step in. Justice Department involvement in a case like this is routine. And as Barr has said, the president is shielded in this regard. Federal employees are shielded with regard to comments that are made while they are serving in office, even if the allegations and the actions happen prior to them taking their official duties. So there is legal precedent. There is outline in the Justice Department guidelines for Barr to take this action. So I think he was justified exactly in doing so.
Well, Bill, I want to get your opinion on that. But it also is interesting that it comes now when we're finding out that one of the reasons that the Republican campaign coffers are so low is that President Trump has been using them to pay for personal legal expenses for him and his family. Your thoughts?
Well, first, I've got to say, routine, really? I invite Alice Stewart or anybody in the White House to give one example where U.S. taxpayers have paid to defend someone who's accused of rape years before they ever took public office. This is not routine. This is unique. This is outrageous. And I think the question that we all should be asking is, why would Bill Barr do this? Why? There's only one reason why, because Donald Trump told him to, because he's trying to get this matter buried so there will not be a court hearing before November 3rd. That's what it's all about. And unfortunately, Bill Barr has really disgraced, if not destroyed, the Justice Department. Its reputation for independence and integrity is gone. It's going to take a long time to rebuild, because Bill Barr considers himself the replacement of Michael Cohen as Donald Trump's personal attorney. And the Justice Department he just uses now as a law firm to defend Donald Trump. And finally, to your point, Robin, I find it very amusing that the president yesterday said, I might shell out $100 million for my reelection campaign, but he can't afford to pay his own legal bills. Well, guess what? As a taxpayer, I don't want to be paying Donald Trump's legal bills.
Bill, you mentioned getting the matter buried. You know, it's already buried in some of the mainstream news publications today by some shocking details from Bob Woodward's new book about President Trump. He had private conversations early in the pandemic and said, President Trump did, that the pandemic was deadly and far more serious than the flu, which is not what he was saying publicly. CNN is playing some clips of Woodward's interviews with Trump. Let's listen.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
I wanted to play it down. There were so many people dying as they in some cases didn't take the virus seriously. Bill, what does this mean for the campaign, these revelations?
Well, I think it's very damaging. First of all, let's realize Bob Woodward is a great journalist. 18 on the record interviews Donald Trump gave Bob Woodward, and we've got the tape. So this is not something the White House can say. Trump never said that. He did say it. We just heard him say it. At the very time after the president said, remember, well, maybe one case, maybe 15, this is nothing. It's never going to happen here. I mean, people were dying across the country. The president was downplaying it. He still downplays it. And now we know that this is what I find so shocking. At the time he was downplaying it publicly, he told Bob Woodward that this was five times more deadly than the flu. And publicly he said, this is just like the flu. So he deliberately misled the American people, which I think you have to say resulted in thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of lives lost. And, you know, Joe Biden is trying to say that this election is a referendum, among other things, but maybe principally on how Donald Trump responded to and handled the coronavirus.
Alice,
I think this makes it happen.
I take tremendous exception to the comments that these deaths are the result of this president, when there are a lot of the tragic deaths as a result of coronavirus that are the result of state legislation and actions that mayors and governors and local municipalities put into effect with regard to closing down or opening up or requiring masks.
But what about these revelations in the Bob Woodward book, Alice?
Look, I think it's concerning. It's concerning. But I will say this, regardless of how he felt privately back then, I'm more concerned about what he's doing publicly now and putting a high priority on getting a vaccine and getting it tested and getting it to market and working to work on contact tracing, working on opening up safely schools and the economy. Because while there's a tremendous health impact from this pandemic, there's also the economic and the emotional and educational impact. And I applaud him
hang on one second. I just got to say, he is holding rallies where people are not socially distancing and most of them are not wearing masks. Isn't that what he's doing now also, Alice?
Absolutely. And I don't agree with that. I think if you're in a public place, you should be wearing a mask. You should social distance. But, you know, it's their individual prerogative on how they want to engage in behavior or associating with other people in public. I personally try to avoid any kind of situations like that.
I'm going
to
jump in now. No, it's my turn. Well, hold on 1 second, Bill. You can hold your thought and bring it back, because I do want to see where this technique of the president's of, you know, meeting people, where it's gotten him. Where are we in the race? The new NBC Marist poll, Alice, shows Joe Biden with a 9-point lead in Pennsylvania and leading Trump by nearly 20 points when it comes to likely suburban voters. So, you know, Bill, on the other hand, are you concerned that Joe Biden isn't pushing back hard enough on President Trump's messaging tying him and Democrats to social unrest and gun violence in cities like Portland and Chicago? You take it, Bill, and any thoughts that you still have about the COVID?
I just have to comment. Donald Trump is still downplaying the coronavirus by holding these rallies like he did in Florida yesterday, like he did at the White House during the convention. He even told a White House reporter this week to take off your mask.
Is that hurting him, do you think?
Possible.
Do you think that's...
Yes, I believe... Well, I think it's certainly not helping him, and I think he's setting the worst possible example. And I salute the mayors and the governors who asked people to wear a mask and asked people to social distance and take those precautions. Back to where the race is today, Robin. I'd have to say, you know, look, a lot of people critical about Joe Biden staying too long in the basement and now just starting to get out, but I checked this morning. The Real Clear Politics average shows Joe Biden, I'm not overconfident here, but at this point, up 7.3% nationwide.
And
he's
and
up
Alice,
in every battleground state. So,
got to give Alice the last word. Alice, is the president's message not working?
It is. If you actually look at the numbers, the top battleground states as listed on Real Clear Politics, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Florida, North Carolina, Arizona, Joe Biden is only up by 1 percentage point in these polls. He was up 4 percentage points just a month ago. And the fact that this is narrowing to such a degree at this key stage of the game goes to show that the momentum is certainly not in Biden's favor.
Well, I just want to give us some numbers. Real Clear Politics,
quickly.
Pennsylvania, 4.3, Wisconsin, +7, Michigan, 3.2, Arizona, 5.7. Joe Biden's leading in the battleground states.
That is Bill Press, the Democratic strategist. Alice Stewart, Republican strategist. Thanks to both of you.
Okay,
thank
guys.
You, Jeremy.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a Master's in Engineering and Management. SDM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Wednesday, September 16th from 9 to 10 a.m., sdm.mit.edu.
Airlines are waiting on Congress to authorize more government assistance, but the relief bill Senate Republicans introduced yesterday does not include any new money for them. Last week, United announced more than 16,000 employees will be furloughed when payroll restrictions attached to the previous federal bailout expire in October. But one air carrier has said they won't take that step. Delta Airlines says it will not have to furlough any more flight attendants this year. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
So both American Airlines and United have said that they will have to lay off tens of thousands of employees if there's no more relief money. How is Delta able to stave off these furloughs?
Furloughs, at least of flight attendants, as you said. Still negotiating with pilots who face some furloughs. What's interesting here, and yes, flight attendants at American and United facing furloughs in big numbers, Delta is the only major airline that doesn't have unionized flight attendants. And that matters because it tends to handle things differently over the years. Now, you might think it's counterintuitive that the airline without the union is the one that's not furloughing flight attendants. But Delta seems to make these calculations at times that to keep the unions off the property, it has to take extra steps to make its employees happy. And that could be what's going on here, because let's face it, come October 1st, it probably doesn't truly need every last flight attendant relative to the travel demand that's in the marketplace.
But union or no union, I imagine that Delta is still in a pretty bad economic position, just as the other airlines are.
Absolutely. It went into this in better shape than others. It was the world's most profitable airline last year. None of these airlines are going to be profitable this year. It's just a question of hopefully not losing too much money. So it had some wiggle room, but burning through cash just like everybody else. And so at some point here, it's going to have to turn the corner on travel demand to be able to support what it's doing in terms of employment.
I want to ask you about something else, Seth. American Airlines has said its employees can wear Black Lives Matter pins on the job. A spokeswoman said the pins are an expression of equality, not a political statement, and the airline plans to work with Black employees to design the pin. What kind of conversations have been happening at the company about this?
Well, there were employees who made exactly the argument that you said. These airlines are careful about not wading into politics too much, walking an ever thinner line. And American generally has done well on equality indexes and those sorts of things. It likes to be seen as a company that embraces diversity. The question until now was whether Black Lives Matter went beyond that. But this is American agreeing with the idea that no, it doesn't.
Do you think the other airlines are going to follow suit? We did see, you know, United got rid of the change fees and then all the other ones did as well. Do you think the other airlines will also allow employees to do this?
Yeah, and in fact, some have already. That's part of where this came from, that employees were saying, hey, we've seen that at other airlines. So, yeah, American getting a lot of press right now for making that move. Not the only one, though, to have done that. In the same sense that JetBlue went first on mandating masks, or United went first among the major airlines in eliminating change fees.
That is Seth Kaplan here now, transportation analyst. And by the way, listeners on WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, can now also see Seth on TV on WHTM Channel 27. Seth, thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Well, let's take a break from the news now for a jazz edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Kiana Faircloth is the voice of Afternoon Jazz at WBGO in Newark, New Jersey. She's also the host of the jazz podcast Artemisy. And joins us now, Kiana, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy. I'm excited to be here.
Well, and tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you first get into jazz?
Well, I was kind of a weird kid, I guess you could say. I started listening to jazz probably in middle school. I was first introduced to the music by my parents. They used to take me to all kinds of concerts. I oftentimes found myself to be the only kid in the jazz club in my hometown of Washington, D.C. We used to frequent a place called Blues Alley a lot. And I actually fell in love with Miles Davis's Kind of Blue. And I used to just literally sit in my room and listen to it and just kind of get taken away in the music.
Well, let's get to some of the music that you have brought us. The first one is called Footprints. This is by Ezra Collective. So tell us why you picked this one.
Oh, I love Ezra Collective. It's the group out of the UK. And this particular rendition of Footprints, of course, Wayne Shorter's original composition coming off of his album, I believe it was 1967's Adam's Apple. And it reminds me that, you know, one of my missions as a DJ on WBGO has been sort of to connect the dots between what's past and present, sort of that idea of Sankofa, having to look back in order to move forward. And I feel like Ezra Collective really does a great job with this version of Footprints. It's actually coming out on an album called Blue Note Reimagined, which is going to be released on October 16th. So really looking forward to that record.
And Ezra Collective, by the way, is made up of millennials. They make a point of pointing that out. Is that unusual in the jazz world?
Well, not so much now. I think the torch has certainly been passed. Millennials taking to this music is something that I have a passion for, being a millennial myself, of course. Mm-hmm. So this is definitely one of those groups that I feel everybody needs to be listening to right now.
All right, well, the next one we have is Zora's Moon by Candace Hoyes. Listen.
Well, if you go outdoors tonight and the moon is up, you get the first state the moon is in right now. But anyhow, if the moon is shining, you go out and you run and it'll follow you.
Now, by the way, the tape that you hear there at the beginning is from a radio interview from 1943. Tell us more about this one.
Yeah, so this one, Zora's Moon, Candace Hoyes was actually inspired to write this based on an interview that Zora Neale Hurston gave, where she recalled being a child and innocently thinking that as she moved about the world, that the moon was following her and only her. So I love this tune because it just really makes you stop and remember, you know, what it means to be innocent as a child, the joy that that brings, especially now, you know, just being happy and being free.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, next up we have Freeze Tag. This is by Terrace Martin, Robert Glasper, Ninth Wonder, and Kamasi Washington, featuring Felix.
They told me put my hands up behind my head. I think they got the wrong one. I'm sick and tired of running. I've been searching for the love one. I've been looking for the dove, and they told me if I move, they gon' shoot me dead. But I think I'm about to go to love. I've been waiting on the summer, so looking back and wondering how we pulled to keep from under. They told me put my hands up behind my head.
So would this fit into the category of jazz?
I think this one, you can say, is a blend of different things. Mm-hmm. Of course, on this tune, you have Terrace Martin, Robert Glasper, Kamasi Washington, all of these cats who find themselves, you know, in several genres of music, lending their talents. But on this tune, the thing that strikes me are the lyrics that Felix sings, you know, about it being summer. But at the same time, if you think about the experience for summer, for people of color in this country, sometimes it isn't as carefree as we'd like for it to be. And so this tune is kind of a reminder that being joyful in the face of everything that's happening around us, you know, it really is a revolutionary act.
All right, the next one we have is If It's Magic. This is by Artemis.
If it's pleasing, then why can't it be never leaving? Like the day that never fails. Like on seashores there are shells. Like the time that always tells. It holds the key to every heart throughout the universe.
Tell us about this one.
This one, I absolutely love. It gives me hope. Cecile McLaurin-Salvant is actually singing this one. And Artemis is a group that's comprised of just a whole bunch of girl power. It's got Renee Rosnes, Annette Cohen, Melissa Aldana, Ingrid Jensen. These women have come together. They are putting out their debut album very soon. And this rendition is actually of a Stevie Wonder tune. And it reminds me that, you know, love still remains, even in everything that's happening right now around us.
All right, we have time for one more. This is All I Need by Jacob Collier featuring Mahalia and Ty Dolla $ign.
Hi. I love the way that I feel when you put your arms over me. Oh, hi.
Hello.
I love the way that you get in the groove and you work with me. Cause every time I think about it, can't stop thinking about it. That you were all I need.
You were all I need.
I love thinking of all the kisses you could give me if I came around.
So this is another London-based jazz musician and another all-star collaboration.
Yeah, Jacob Collier really is incredible. He's a powerhouse. He's a producer. He's a multi-instrumentalist. And he has this way of bringing people together that you wouldn't even imagine he could, like Mahalia and Ty Dolla $ign on this one. So I absolutely love this record and the lyrics as well on this one. You know, a sweet reminder that even though we're in the midst of a pandemic, we can still, you know, have the hope of new love. And so that's sort of been the thing for me during everything that's happening around us, to sort of remind myself that there's hope, there's love, there's still great things to look forward to. And this is one of those tracks that really reminds me of that.
It's Kiana Faircloth, host of Afternoon Jazz on WBGO in Newark, New Jersey, and host of the Artemisy podcast. Kiana, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
And you can find all our picks at our Spotify playlist. It's NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
At a number of universities, officials are linking clusters of coronavirus infections to fraternal groups, the University of Mississippi, the University of New Hampshire. We reported on Indiana University, where there's an outbreak in several Greek houses, which in most cases are owned by national fraternal organizations. Schools have little leverage. So are fraternities doing enough to stop the COVID spread? Judson Horace is president and CEO of the North American Interfraternity Conference. And Judson, let's jump right in. The Pan-Hellenic Conference of Sororities is now recommending that all rushing, this is vetting new members, be moved online. Are you recommending the same thing?
Well, most of our chapters have moved to a virtual experience for recruitment as well as daily operations. We haven't been at the position of mandating yet because we have a more informal system.
When you say it's a more informal system, there's been criticism of that. We looked on your website. It says any gathering over 10 people will be at risk, but you don't say should be banned. It says chapters should encourage students to report if they're feeling unwell, but it doesn't say if there should be any penalties if they don't. There's no mention of face masks. There is one picture of one that we could find. You know, is this a fail?
Absolutely not. I don't know where you're looking, but we've spent all summer talking to thousands and thousands of students about wearing a mask, washing your hands, and social distancing.
So you say that you recommend masks?
Absolutely. We've been saying it all along. So if you check our Facebook page or the Fraternal Think Tank, there's a lot of resources we've been putting out about that.
Well, but what do you do about, I mean, we see the pictures, we see the parties, and we see people not wearing masks. And there's also something that is slightly out of your control. It's the nature of fraternities and sororities in these Greek houses. It's communal living. I mean, they share everything and they are, you know, closer together than dorm rooms are. It's what people want to be a part of, that community. Did you ever think, you know, because of the different nature, I mean, Indiana University, for instance, there's much more of an outbreak among the Greek houses than there are in the dorm rooms for that reason. Do you ever think, gee, maybe we should be thinking about something else for fraternity and sorority members, some other living arrangement?
Yeah, so let's take a look at Indiana. There has been zero conduct violations of throwing events in the house. The Interfraternity Council has outlawed that, and there's been zero individual conducts related to this. Now, there is a community living environment issue here. We disagree that moving them out is the right call. Right now, all of the experts say if you have the condition and you're asymptomatic, you should stay in quarantine. I think it's also fair to say that the larger campus community has these challenges in athletic teams, But there's also a reason that thousands of parents from Indiana University that have sons in fraternities called us and said, we want to make sure they stay there because their experience of college is important. And we need to keep the students who are with COVID and are asymptomatic in quarantine.
You're absolutely right, because there is concern that if they go home, first of all along the way, they will infect people and then infect them at home. It's hard to find housing in a college town at this point. But is there anything else that you can be doing? I mean, you know there are parties. The party at New Hampshire had 100 people at it. Why not just say, no, we're banning that and there'll be penalties?
Well, there are. They are banned, and those students are going to be held accountable, and we support that. So,
how are they being held accountable?
Well, an example at Indiana University, students were suspended from school. So we support all of that. But you got to get the mixture right here, because the vast majority of students are working together. But if they feel like the university is going to treat them as the problem rather than as a part of the solution, then we're going to have a bigger problem where they won't work with us on contact tracing and random testing.
I hear you. You want to make sure they work with you. But some would say you, in particular, spent a lot of time defending fraternities from underage drinking, lawsuits over sexual assaults, hazing, deaths from hazing, and now the accusation that this is where the keg parties are. I would think it would be in your best interest for the future of fraternities, which many have been shut down, to impose some sort of a fine system, no?
Absolutely. We think stronger than fine system. I don't think they should be members of fraternities if they blatantly violate these expectations. We've met with countless campuses dealing with this. There's a reason why students are joining in record numbers even during COVID. The stress and anxiety college students are facing, the fraternity provides them love and care and support that they find in their brotherhood.
I just want to be clear. The schools might suspend students, but are you saying that as an organization, you are thinking of fining them, because you're not right now? So is that something you're considering?
Well, that's done at the individual national membership level, but students are being evicted in some cases. Students are being taken their membership away, and some are losing privileges. So it really depends on each circumstance. But our role is to have awareness and then encourage accountability, which we are. We are also advocating for the vast majority of students who are meeting the expectations and are trying to make a big difference here.
That's Judson Horace, president and CEO of the North American Interfraternity Conference. Judson, thank you.
Thank you.
By the way, we said that there wasn't prominent mention of masks on his organization's website section on COVID guidance, and there is not. But there is on the Facebook page. It mentions masks frequently. Here now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.